We want to take this opportunity to welcome those that are visiting with us. We want you to know that we're happy that you're here. You're our honored guest. If there's anything we can do to answer any of your questions concerning things that are done here, we'd be more than happy to do so. We hope that you'll stay a few moments after services, that we might get better acquainted, that we might have a better understanding of you and you of us, and we hope that together we will open our minds to the study of God's Word. Just a couple of things before we begin. As you can tell, there's many holes in the audience this morning. Many of our number are out of town for one reason or another. Please make a note of that and see if we can be of help to some who are ill and not able to be out with us. Also, this would Sunday marks the end of this particular teaching quarter. I would ask all you teachers who have been teaching in the class this quarter to make sure you have all of your outlines in the master books that are in my office, and I'm going to put those in the library tonight. So if you have any lessons that need to get in there, please make sure that you put those in there. And also, as probably will be mentioned, it's in your bulletin. As we begin our study in the book of Matthew, if you do not have a book, whether you're in a grade school class or out here in the adult class, see me and we'll make sure that we get that taken care of as we begin our new study on Wednesday. This morning, I want to conclude our study together of the meaning of life. We have been preaching through the book of Ecclesiastes that we studied in our adult class and in our classes here just a few weeks ago. And I want to finish this particular series of lessons in trying to find the answer to the meaning of life. And we begin this today in chapter number 10. In chapter number 10, we see that God's favor from rulers isn't always certain, and using wisdom for our own good can help us in many areas of life. We see in verse 4, if the spirit of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses. Pacifies, it simply means to appease anger or agitation. When folks are angry, and when people get angry with you, you do not gain anything and you do not solve the problem by returning anger for anger. The Bible tells us in James chapter 1 and verse 19 that we should be slow to anger. We know in Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 1, we are told that a soft answer just takes away wrath. We need to learn to maintain a calmness when we are opposed, even by those who are in authority over us. That may be true in the workplace, that may be true in our government, that could also be true in relationships that we have. We always need to remember that we need to control our emotions and our reactions to what people do to us. You know, he goes on to talk about that ruling exalts the unworthy and sometimes holds down those who are worthy in verse 5 and 6. This proceeds from the ruler. Sadly, even in our society, many times favoritism and partiality manifest their place in government. That's not right. It should be different, but sometimes that's the way it happens. We should not let that overwhelm us to the fact that that makes all government bad. We should not let that overwhelm us that that makes the order that God designed in the world seem to be inferior. It is not. Just because men make bad decisions with God's designs do not mean that the designs are bad. Remember we talked about last week in Romans 13th chapter that government was established for our good. That doesn't mean that government will always do what is best in our own best interest. That doesn't mean that it won't make mistakes. It doesn't mean that it will always be just. It does not mean that only the worthy and qualified people will be in those positions. But it does mean that we must maintain a sense of respect for that authority and for that office. You know, sadly, many times, this same principle is seen in the church. If you look down in verse 7, it says, I have seen servants on horses while princes walk on the ground like servants. You know, sometimes, even in the church, the best people aren't used in the best position. You know, that there is something to be gained by an older Christian. They have experience. They have wisdom. They have knowledge that maybe as a younger person we have not attained yet or we have not gained yet. And so there would be much profit in us sitting and listening and respecting that older wisdom and that aged understanding that we might gain a better perspective of how we are to act and what we are to do. You know, in the book of Titus, it talks about the older women teaching the younger women and the older men teaching the younger men. You know, one of the great problems that's in the Lord's church today is that this process has reversed itself. Too many times we have the younger teaching the older. That's out of sequence. That doesn't mean that it's wrong, but when that emphasis is continually seen, it has a respect to the strength of the church. When it is the younger continually teaching the older, there is something wrong in that premise. And we need to remember to use that which we have to our own good and for our own benefit. And you know, he begins in verse 8 through 10, and he talks about manifold dangers in earthly undertakings. And he gives some examples of where wisdom is needed. He talks about digging a pit and the danger of maybe falling into it. You break through a wall and you may get through the wall, but on the other side you'll find a serpent in it and you're bitten and you die. Quarry stones, you can be hurt by them. They can fall. They could topple on top of you. We can also see that one that splits wood must be careful that he's not endangered by the splitting of the wood to the harm of his own life. And the axe is dull. The axe is dull, and a person that goes out to chop wood, if he hasn't sharpened his axe, he may get the wood cut, but it's going to take a lot more effort because he didn't prepare the axe. What's his point in all these dangers of earthly undertakings? Well, his point is that wisdom brings success. Whenever you apply wisdom in any situation, it will make that situation better. That's true in the physical, that's true in the spiritual. We need to understand that applying wisdom to things in life make it successful, that makes it profitable. And you know, if you read instructions in something you're doing, but you don't follow the instructions and then your job doesn't go as well as it could, or it's not as doesn't go as smooth as you like, maybe it's because you didn't apply the wisdom into the instruction that you got. Now, he's not just talking about physical things. Let's talk for a minute about a spiritual application of that, where wisdom can be profitable. Wisdom pays dividends in any venture, and this is no more true than in the spiritual arena. We need to understand that we need to sharpen our wisdom. And you cannot sharpen your wisdom, and you cannot make your application better if you do not have the knowledge to do so. That's why it is very important that we, so to speak, sharpen our axe, spiritually speaking, by sharpening our understanding of God's Word. We need to understand what truth is. We need to know how truth can help us. We need to know how truth can benefit us. We need to know how truth, when correctly applied, can make us live better, make us be better examples, make us better influences, and make our life much more peaceful and contentful. We need to understand that there is profit in taking God's knowledge and making it an everyday application of wisdom. Brethren, what we have today, not only in the religious world at large, but many times in the Lord's church, we have a lot of people that know a lot of Bible. They don't know how to live it. They don't know how to teach it. They don't know how to apply it. Then how can it be a benefit to anyone? How can it instruct them? How can it guide them? How can it make them better people if they don't know how to live what they know? Brethren, over and over you've heard me say many times over the years that I've been here that there is no excuse for us not to grow in our knowledge. If we do not grow in our knowledge, the problem is not with the teaching program. The problem is not with the preacher. The problem is not with the elders. The problem is with us. We need to understand that growth is something that comes to each one of us in a different way and in different time. We all don't grow by the same rate. What may work for you may not work for me. But bottom line, we must grow. 2 Peter 3:18 teaches us that we must grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. We're told to study to show ourselves approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. 2 Timothy 2:15. We discussed a few months ago the concept of being ready to give an answer in 1 Peter 3, verse 15. You can't be ready to give an answer if you don't know the information of the question. We must understand that knowledge is the key. Knowledge is the key in any area, and it's still so in the church. We need to know what's true. We need to know what is right. We need to know what works. And then we need to do it and apply it in the right way. You know, in verse number 11, he talks about a serpent may bite when it is not charmed, and the babbler is no different. A serpent doesn't need to be charmed to strike or bite a person. If he is endangered, he will strike. They protect their domain when an intruder invades their territory. People who bear tales and gossip can also strike without warning. There is nothing that's more harmful to a church than a gossiper. There's nothing more harmful in the church than a backbiter. There is nothing more harmful than a whisperer, somebody that just seems to be stirring trouble underneath and then stands back and doesn't understand what's going on. Brethren, the Bible, especially in the book of Proverbs, talks many, many times about the problem with talebearing and gossiping. We need to understand that if somebody has done something that you need to tell somebody, the first person you need to tell is them. Not me, not someone else. It's amazing how much people think the preacher should know. It's absolutely, I don't know, I guess they think my life's incomplete. If I just don't know everything about all of you, that somehow that my life will be empty. Well, let me tell you, I have enough to worry about that I don't need to know about everything that you think I need to worry about. Brethren, we need to learn that when we have problems with each other, and we will, there are times when we're going to have problems. There's times when we're going to be misunderstood. There are times when we are not going to clarify ourselves very well. There are times when we're going to speak before we think. That is going to happen. You know why? Because we're human beings. And because we don't always use good judgment. But when that happens, there is a way to solve the problem. And the way to solve the problem is to go directly to the source. If you have a problem with something that I say in this pulpit, you don't need to go see Rita. You need to come see me. Because she's not up here preaching, I am. And the same way, if I have a problem with you, I don't need to go see your brethren. I need to come see you. And brethren, if that simple prescription was followed, you know, there'd be a lot less problems in many churches if that simple prescription was followed. If we would just have the courage and the love that we ought to have one for another, that when I have a difficulty with you, what should I want to do? You remember Jesus teaching in Matthew chapter 5? He touched upon this when he talked about offering you gift at the altar, and there you remember that you have some ought against your brother. You remember what Jesus said? He said, leave your gift at the altar, go and be reconciled to your brother, and then come again and offer your gift. What's the principle that Jesus is talking about? The principle is that we need to take care of our problems. We don't need to spread the problem and make it worse. We need to deal directly with whatever it is. And all this means, brethren, real basically, is that we deal honestly with one another. And brethren, we're commanded to do that. We're commanded to be honest and forthright in our dealings with one another. We even command to be that way in all our dealings with our fellow man, that we would do which is right and which is honorable. And then, you know, in verse 12 through 15, he talks about the tongue. And he talks about the tongues of the wise and the foolish. The words of the wise are gracious. They're not unkind. They're not harsh. They're helpful. They're edifying. They build up. Colossians 4, verse 6 makes that same argument. A fool is consumed by his own words. He doesn't know when to shut up. There are people that just make it worse because they don't know when to stop. They just keep on and on until eventually they do a lot of harm. We need to understand that words begin and end in foolishness, according to Proverbs 12 and verse 23. Also, it multiplies words. A person that is full of words is empty talk, according to Proverbs 29 and verse number 11. Can any of us predict the future with any certainty? If we could, we'd all be a lot richer than we are if we could predict it with certainty, if we knew exactly what was going to happen in the future. When one has no direction or no understanding, thus becomes a burden to all, exalting himself and being a great person and can't even find his way in the city. That's the example in the book of Ecclesiastes. There's no profit in that. We need to understand that false pride and arrogance is you're on your way to fall, according to Proverbs 16 and 18. There's nothing more distasteful, brethren, than an arrogant person. And I don't care if it's in your secular work. I don't care if it's in a family relationship. And it's especially distasteful in the area of religion. Nobody likes a holier-than-thou person. Nobody wants to know it all. And we need to remember that how we sometimes carry ourselves and how we handle our words and how we express ourselves can very much have a great impact on whether we will be successful or whether we will not be in carrying out our responsibilities as Christians. You know, he goes on to say in this chapter that a king is more concerned about physical things than leading than all the people suffer. How do you keep further damage from being done? In verse 18, he says, because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness, the hands of the house leak. A feast is made for laughter, and the wine makes merry, but money answers everything. Do not curse the king, even in your thought. Do not curse the rich, even in your bedroom. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and a bird in flight may tell the matter. We need to understand, why would you fix a roof quickly? Probably so the rain don't come in on you. Try to take care of a car. We call it preventive maintenance. We need to understand that we can keep further damage from being done by taking care of a matter quickly. Laziness brings nothing but waste and destruction to anything it touches. Some things in life bring enjoyment into our lives. And, you know, I thought it was interesting when Solomon said money is the answer to everything. Well, I think he's being facetious. Money is a powerful tool. And money is an important thing, but only is it good and honorable when it's used in the right way and when we look at it with the right perspective. One must carefully guard their thoughts and their tongues. You know, I've often heard people in my presence say, whoop, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But that's inaccurate. That's an inaccurate statement. That's not what they meant. What they meant was, I didn't mean to express what I was thinking because I didn't want you to know. But you see, you can't say it until you think it. And if you're thinking something that you don't want to say, you don't need to be thinking it. Stop and think for a minute, brethren. If there's something we don't want somebody else to know, or if there's something we don't want to tell somebody, why in the world do we have it in our head to begin with? If you have it in your head, somewhere it's going to come out. And if it comes out and is done in an ill-advised way, it can cause much harm. We need to, again, this goes back to that we need to be able not to speak evil of one another. We need to be honest and forthright with our dealing with one another. In chapter number 11, he relates wisdom to business ventures. He says in verse 1, to cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a serving to 7 and also to 8, for you do not know what evil will come on the earth. We need to give to others. We need to be able to use our opportunities wisely. In the book of Galatians, chapter 6, it says, bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. In Galatians chapter 6, in verse 10, it says that we ought to do good unto all men, especially those of a household of faith. We need to understand that we have the responsibility when we have the ability and the opportunity to help other people. And when you help one, that does not mean your responsibility is ended. There are too many people in the world that just think when they've helped one person, then that's good and that's great, and they've helped somebody for this year, and next year they'll help somebody else. That's not exactly the way the Bible talks about it. The Bible talks about opportunity, and the Bible talks about seizing opportunity. And we ought to be people that are looking for ways that we can help other people, not just in a monetary way, although we may be able to do that, but more in other things and areas that they really need help in. And one of the greatest helps that they have in life is their spiritual needs. That is something we always ought to be looking for opportunity to see. That is something that we should always be looking that we can help people in a spiritual way. And if you don't know opportunity, then you can never help someone if you don't even know what opportunity looks like. You know, he mentions two natural consequences in verse 4. He talks about the clouds of rain, and he talks about a tree falling in the forest. What is his point? His point is a good must be done while there is opportunity there. Circumstances can change and can cut away your opportunity. We must see the sense of urgency in the greatest need that man has is sin. I'm going to tell you, friend, your neighbor's greatest need is not you being a good neighbor. Your friends in this world, their greatest need is not you just being a friend to them. The greatest need that all men have is the need for the remedy for sin. And we need to be seizing those opportunities and using our time wisely to be able to share that with people who need it the most. Many adversities of life and many mysteries baffle us. And he gives some examples in the 11th chapter. He talks about the bones growing in the womb. How do they do that? How does that child, when it's conceived, grow hands and feet and all the bones of the skeleton system and the system that takes care of all of our bodily needs? How does it do that? We don't see it, but we see the end result. We don't understand that, but we see the end result of it. Do I understand the operations of the providence of God? Can I tell you every time this is where God acts by his providence? This is just extenuating circumstance. This is where God has acted. This is where God has not acted. Nobody can do that because we're not God. There are many things in this world that will baffle us in understanding how God does what he does. But that nevertheless should not bother us and in any way lessen that he does do for us. We need to understand, brethren, that sometimes we must do God's will and allow things to take their course. We may not always understand why it's this way. We may not always understand why things work out the way that they do. But we should never doubt that God's hand is in the equation. And when you leave God out of the equation, as we said throughout this book, then you're going to find life very difficult. Should we wait for the exact best time to act? Look at verse 6. It says, in the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand. For you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. You know, sometimes people have to wait for everything to be exactly right before they act. And you know, one of the areas that I find this in a lot is in the area of obedience to God. You know, I've talked to many people who have fallen away from the church. And one of the things they tell me is, well, I know I'm wrong, and I know I need to change, but I got some things I got to work out, and then I'll be back. And I've always wondered, and I've always told people, has told me that, is what would it take to make the situation right? Tell me what would I need to do to make this the right time for you to get your life in order? I've asked the same question to people who are outside of Christ, who need to obey the gospel, and I've asked them the same question. What do I need to do to impress upon you your need and the urgency of you to obey the gospel? And one of the favorite days that people have is not even on your calendar. It's called Sunday. And it's the very favorite day of many people in this life, even some of my brethren. But Sunday is not on your calendar. And that's leaving God out of the equation. Do you remember in James chapter 3? If you turn over there for a moment, you remember that we must leave God in the equation when we're talking about time. Because God has a hand in that. In James chapter 3, and in verse number 14, the writer James says, chapter 4, verse 13, come now, and you say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life is even the vapor that appeareth for a little time and vanishes away. Instead, we ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or do that. But now you're boasting your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. We need to understand that God has control of the clock. You do not. I do not. And we need to respect that. And we need to see the urgency of doing the things that God has required of us. Because we do not know how long we will have upon this good earth. We don't know when the Lord is coming back. We don't know when life is coming to an end. And since that's true, then we ought to use our time wisely. Truly, the simple blessings of God are wonderful, according to verse 7. Just never forget that even when it's good, never forget that the dark days are right around the corner. Brethren, life's going to have good days. But life's also going to have dark days. There's going to be days of joy. There's going to be days of pain and gloom. We need to understand to keep a focus and a realistic perspective about life. We must accept adversity as well as the good. Job had to learn that in Job chapter 1, verse 2 through 9, chapter 2, 9 and 10, when his wife wanted him to curse God and guy, he said, made the statement in verse 10, should we accept and receive good from God, and then when we receive bad, turn our back on him? But you know, many people do that. Many people do that. When it's bad, they blame God. The faithful child of God won't crumble when the times come that are difficult. You know, to be sure, vanity is right around the corner, and what it does is keeps you humble. It keeps you humble, brethren, if you understand that it's good today, it may not be tomorrow. It's good tomorrow, but it may not be the next day. It may be good this year, but it may not be next year. What it does is teaches you to appreciate things. Teaches you humility. It also teaches you something that's very, very important. In utter dependence upon the God of heaven. And understanding that nothing would be either way if it wasn't for the love and the mercy of God. We need to accept that. And then in verse 9 through really the first verse of chapter 12, he talks about three things that are directed at youth. And these three things that are directed at youth are very important principles. I call them the three R's. And the three R's are three pieces of advice. It has to do, first of all, with rejoicing. You know, young people, you should enjoy your youth. It only comes around once. All the energy and all the things that you want to do and experience, you ought to do that. And we ought to rejoice when we have our youth and to do the things that young people do. But never forget that there is a consequence for all the choices that you make as a young person. Now, we need to understand that it's okay to have a good time. It's okay to enjoy life. And it's okay to have fun. But it's not okay to do it at the expense of your soul. That's cost too much. And what God is saying is keep life in a balance. Rejoice, enjoy your youth, enjoy the things that you can do as a young person. Enjoy the vitality that you have, the energy, and all the things that you can experience. God didn't put you here, young people, to be unhappy, but he also wanted you to keep a balance. He wanted you to keep a proper perspective so you don't get carried away and end up losing your soul in the process. He next tells them to remove some things. How many of us would like to go back and turn back the clock and change some of the decisions that we made in the past? Because now we're smarter, and if we were that smart then, we wouldn't have done what we did. But you know what? We can't do that. But you know, there's sometimes you need to remove things from your life. You know, evil must be removed. It doesn't make any difference why you did it or what you did. If it's evil, it's got to be removed. Galatians 5, 19 through 21 gives a list of the works of the flesh, and he ends that particular section of Scripture by saying that anyone that does such things cannot inherit the kingdom of God. It says the same thing in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 through 11. And then in Colossians 3, 5 through 10, he talks about mortifying and put to death your members. There's things in life that you've got to remove. There's times in life that there's things that are there that need to be taken out. They need to be cut out in a figurative sense. And if it's sin, Isaiah 59 says that separates us from God. That says that's a transgression of God's law. And if it's there, it's got to be removed. Because if it doesn't get removed, it will overwhelm the rest of the body. What happens if you get cancer in your body and they can't get rid of it? It takes hold and goes through your whole body. That's why we have chemotherapy and radiation. That's why they have surgeries that they take that cancer out so it can't damage the rest of your body. Same thing with sin. Sin does the same thing. If you let sin go unchecked and you don't deal with it and you don't get it out, then it can destroy the whole body. And what we're talking about here is not your physical body. It's talking about your soul. So you've got to remove it. But the thing that will help you do both of these first two R's is the third R. Remember. We need to remember and never forget our obligations to our Creator. We need to remember who we are. And we even need to do that in our youth. You know, the world says young people need to sow their wild oats. But the world's not telling you what that costs. Oh, you could do that. You might live through it. You might get through it. But you might not, too. And see, the world's not going to tell you that. Satan's not going to tell you that. So we need to remember God in our youth. Why? Before the difficult days come. You know, youth is a wonderful time. You have the least responsibility that you're ever going to have in your life is when you're young. You have more energy than you know what to do with. You have more opportunities and you have more decisions to make than you know what to do. And on top of that, it seems that you have your whole life in front of you. But if you forget God in that process, and you forget to make him part of your life, then when the days become difficult and the decisions become more hard and the way becomes a little bit more difficult and you get overwhelmed with the life that you've chosen, then you can just push God completely out of the picture. That's why there's a great advantage to remember God in the days of our youth, because it can mold Him as part of our life, that whatever we do, He's always in the focus and in the center. You know, that's one of the reasons we pray often, that our children might do the things that are right in life, that it might carry over for their faithfulness in the future. I don't think any of us as parents want any more for our children but to be faithful to God. Isn't that the greatest desire any of us have as parents? Is for our children to always be faithful to God. Because you know why that's important? Because no matter what they do in life, if they do that, they've won. They've been a success. If all they do in life is be faithful to God and raise godly children and have happy homes and have happy marriages, if that's all they do in life, they've been a great success. And we have been a success as a parent. You know, too many of us and too many people in the world measure success in our children by the things that they accomplish. I believe success is measured in spiritual things, and they ought to take priority in our life. But you know, in chapter 12, he talks about something that many of you understand. We're getting old. This preacher included. We are growing older day by day. There is nothing that I can do about it. My body grows older. Your body will grow older. And then in verses 3 through 7, he gives some metaphors of old age. He talks about the keepers of the house tremble. That's your hands and your arms. He talks about the strong men bowing down. That's the legs and your back. The grinders ceasing to few. That's your teeth. Those who look through the glass window grow dim. That's your eyes. When the doors are shut in the street, the sound of grinding is low. That's your ears. When one rises up at the sound of a bird, you're a light sleeper. You rise up early. All daughters of music are brought low. They have empty sounds. Afraid of heights and terrors in the way, obstacles in our way overcome us. When almond trees blossom, that's when your hair turns white. The grasshopper is a burden. Small things annoy you. Think about it for a minute. Same things annoy you today that annoyed you 20 years ago. You know they don't. Small things can annoy us. And desires fail. Appetites and desires cease. They're not what they used to be. Mourners go about in the street. You know why? Because death is near. Brethren, every day that we live in this life, it teaches us the truth of these things. That our bodies grow older, they grow frailer, they grow weaker, and we are heading closer and closer to our eternal appointment with the grave. Make no mistake about it, that's what life's all about. We're headed there, and we need to understand that. And to make that even more emphatic, after listing these things of old age, he talks about four things as an expression of referring to one's death. He talks about the silver cord is loose. He talks about the golden bowl is broken. The pitcher shattered before the fountain, and the wheel broken at the well. And all of this is to imply upon us and impress upon us that we are going to die. We are going to leave this world in some way or some fashion. And we need not to be making light of that. We need to accept that. That's our case and our lot in life, that we are going to die. And then in verse 7 he says, our bodies will return to the dust. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God that gave it. We must remember that when we were created, God breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, Genesis 2, verse 7. We are of God's greatest creation because our human body tabernacles our spirit. And it is the spirit that is going back to God. It is the spirit that's going to live on in eternity. It is the spirit that is the most precious part of man, and it's the part that he cannot see, but it is the part that is affected by everything that he does. And our bodies are going to turn to dust. We have a dual nature. Many believe that that is the end, but it is not. It is just the beginning of another stage. But where that stage begins has everything to do with what we do in this stage. And Solomon ends this book in the way that he began it. In verse number 8 he says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Solomon has shown the vanity and the futility of earthly pursuits. When life is only looked at from a human vantage point, it is empty, it is useless, it is unprofitable. When you live life just for what you can get out of life, if your focus is upon this earth, if your focus is upon earthly possessions and wealth, earthly pursuits, if that is your focus, you are spinning your wheels. Life will prove empty to you in the end. Solomon taught us that lesson. In verse 9 and 10, Solomon gives he's the author and identifies himself. He was a wise man who diligently sought and delivered wisdom to us. Words acceptable, upright, and true. Could we say that he was a wise teacher? Sadly, many still doubt the truth of his words, and they are still trying to seek and find what Solomon has already gave us the answer to. You know what is the greatest tragedy of the book of Ecclesiastes? You know what is the greatest tragedy of the life of its author? Is that the great wisdom that he had, the great advantages that he had, all of them proved little in his life because he did not practice them himself. But what he did do is he gave us the benefit of his life of futility of search and gave us the answer that we don't have to go through the exercise. That we can spare ourselves this uneasiness and this helplessness if we understand and keep things focused and what is truly important. What are the value of these words? He talks about two things. He talks about goads. Now, goads are things that are used to urge forward and prod oxen along as they travel along. And you know, the wise words that Solomon has given us, they prod us along. They encourage us to do these things that are right and honorable. And then he talks about nails. You know, nails fasten things. And these fasten, they strengthen and establish us. We need to understand, look down at verse number 11. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And the further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making of many books there is no end, and much study is a wearisome to the flesh. You know, you can be overly wise, and he talked about that earlier. You can consume yourself with world knowledge and world wisdom. You can consume yourself with the ways of the world. You can consume yourself with the knowledge that comes from a human standing point. And when you do, it's just going to weary your flesh. It's not going to profit you anything, because it can't give you the real answers to the questions of life that you seek. So what should we do? What is the end result of all of Solomon's labor? What is the end result of all of his experience? All of the wisdom that he sought, all of the life lessons that he learned, and all the things that he experienced and noticed while he lived under the sun. What did Solomon learn? In chapter 12, in verse 13 and 14, he summed this up in this book. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is bad. After the consideration of all these thoughts that he has presented in these first 11 chapters, he concludes that there's only two things that man needs to focus on while he lives in this world. One is to fear God. What does that mean, to fear God? Brethren, that means that you need to respect him. You need to respect his position. He is the one who created us. He is the one that gives us life. He is the one that sustains our life. He is the one that makes things as well, and the joys that we experience and the things that we love in this life. He makes it all possible. We need to respect him because we need to understand that he is powerful. We need to respect that he will do all the things that he said he will do, and that means the bad along with the good. You know, in my relations and my discussions with members of other religions, they often tell me that, Keith, you're a person that serves God out of fear. In some ways, yes, I do. You know, I do fear God. I respect him, but I fear him too, in the way that we understand fear. Am I fearful of what God can do to me? You had better believe it. I want to read you a passage. It's in Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28, verse 10, chapter 10, verse number 29. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will be thought of worthy of those who trample the Son of God underfoot, counting the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace. For he himself has said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. The Lord will judge his people. Now I want you to look at verse 31. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 29, it says, our God is a consuming fire. Yes, I do not want to fall before the seat of the throne of God, and I do not want to be unprepared, and I do not want to be lost. And I think about that. I ponder that. And there's nothing about that picture that endears me to try to let that happen. How about you? You know, we talk about thinking about heaven, and we need to do that. And we need to think about the glories and the beauty of things that God has prepared for us. But brethren, we need to think about that other place too. Because it exists. That place of consuming fire. That place of unquenchable torment. That place of eternal separation from God. That place where the worm dieth not. Where there's outer darkness and there's gnashing of teeth. None of those things paint a pretty picture in your mind, do they? Don't forget about them. They are real. They are real. If you want to avoid that place, you're going to have to work at it. You're going to have to make some conscious decisions to go the other way. Because if you don't, that will become a reality. But you see, if I fear God, if I respect God, it's only makes common sense that I'm going to do what he says. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. That doesn't mean you may agree with them. That doesn't even mean you may like them. But if you want to gain heaven, you're going to have to be obedient. It is not a matter of selection. You cannot pick and choose what you want to obey. You cannot pick and choose what you want to do. And you cannot accept God on your terms. It won't work. You've got to obey his commandments. And you know what? You know why? Because this is why you were put on the earth. For this is the whole duty of man. You were put here to serve your Creator. You were here to serve him who gave you life. You were put here to do the things that he would want you to do while you live here. But one of the greatest things that God has given you and he has given me is he's given us the ability to choose for ourselves whether we take him at his word or whether we doubt the words that he tells us. Make no mistake about this, brethren. You and I will be determined what we hear when we stand before the judgment seat of Christ on that fateful day. That's why he says in verse 14, he will bring every work into judgment. Every secret thing will be brought into judgment. You know what? That's humbling. Let me ask you a question this morning. Are there things you try to hide from your brother? Maybe hide from your wife? Maybe hide from your husband. Maybe hide from your friends. Think you've done it? Think you're pulling off? You're not. Because Hebrews 4:13 says that we are naked and open in his sight to whom we will give an account. You know what? You can fool your brethren. You can fool your friends. You can fool your family, and you can even deceive yourself for a period of time. But when it's all said and done, you haven't fooled anyone. Because God's going to bring every secret thing into judgment. Brethren, that's humbling. I want you to think about that. Are there things in your life this morning that you're glad your brethren don't know about you? But doesn't it bother you that God does? So I don't know. Doesn't hurt me, does it? But God knows. You know, we need to understand, brethren, that God's taking note. We're building a record. We're building our case. What's your evidence say? If you had to stand before Jesus Christ tonight, and you had to give an account of your life, what would the evidence say in your life? Would it condemn you? Or would it gain you heaven as your eternal home? I want you to know something here this morning, every one of you. You're building your case. You're either strengthening the record or you're destroying your chances of gaining heaven. You're doing one or the other. And you know what? It will always be that way. You will always have this choice to make. Please take your psalm books out and turn to page 393. You got that right. What is the meaning of life? The meaning of life, brethren, is understanding two things. And I'm not talking about fearing God and keeping His commandments. Two things we need to know about life are very simple. And they are this. That we're not going to live forever. There's going to be an end to our existence someday. And number two is that we will be judged. Hebrews 9:27 teaches both those truths. And that tells me two things that are very important. Number one, urgency. Because I have a limited time. Number two is that eternity is a lot longer.